KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
There is nothing as amazing as this. This incredibly thin and beautiful iPad mini.
She's not dead.
Not dead? Are you mad?
The village council, it was clear we needed to take action to bring back the salmon, which are so critically important to our people.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in for Steve Scherer. You heard a little clip there of the iPad Mini's release. We'll be talking about the iPad Mini and a lot of other technology stories of the week with Todd Bishop later in the hour. You also heard a clip from the movie White Zombie. Robert Horton's joining us to talk about movies about zombies that perhaps are more of the black and white kind, to put us in a nostalgic mood and get us ready for Halloween. But joining us first is Vaughn Palmer to talk about that other clip that we heard from the Village Council about an experimental fertilization of the ocean up in British Columbia. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello. How are you today, Katie?
Good. So this week brings us the story of an ecological experiment gone wrong. What happened?
It's a bizarre story, fascinating in a way, too. What you have is a guy who was hired to go out in the ocean off Haida Gwaii, which is Queen Charlotte Islands, used to be called. It's now called Haida Gwaii, south of the Alaska Panhandle, and dump 100 tons of iron ore in the ocean as an experiment. And the experiment that was being conducted was that iron ore plankton forms around it, removes carbon dioxide from the air, and so this might be a means of combating global warming. It also has a commercial dimension to it, because if you could show that this worked as a form of carbon capture, you might be able to get credits in a carbon trading market like the one in Europe and pay back the cost of the experiment, which I think was about $2.5 million. So that's the concept. That's what happened. And there's an awful lot of outrage going around on this one from both environmentalists, government regulators, and including some members of the Haida people, who are the First Nation, the Aboriginal people, who live in the Queen Charlotte Islands, as they were formerly known, now Haida Gwaii.
So I know that a lot of the concerns about this project were over it being geoengineering. That's counteracting global warming by deliberately manipulating the environment. But the businessman behind this big experiment, Russ George, denies that that's what he was trying to accomplish. So what was he doing?
He says it was an experiment. It wasn't planet forming or geoengineering or anything. He was conducting an experiment. He was commissioned to do it by the village council in those islands. And he was paid, I think, $2.5 million to do it. That he informed regulators, or that regulators were informed, and they gathered data, and that data will be used to show whether or not this actually works. The amount of iron ore dumped in the ocean, 100 tons, sounds like an awful lot, but it's big ocean. So in that sense, it qualifies as an experiment. But I think the outrage around this is twofold. One, that the native community itself did this with internal opposition and with opposition from outside, that regulators weren't really involved, that in fact they were warned not to do this. Canadian regulators are opposed to this. And I think in general the idea that this is kind of a rogue operation where you just had somebody go outside, the oceans are unregulated in a sense. Somebody just go out and did it and dumped it in the ocean, and this is not necessarily the kind of experiment that environmental regulators want to have happening off their coastline.
Well, I understand that NOAA was somehow involved.
NOAA?
Yeah.
In
this article, it says that they loaned him some floats to monitor the progress. I'm not sure what they exactly were called. Well, all right. If you don't know anything about it, I won't ask.
Yeah, I mean, there has been, there are aspects of this where they're collecting data. The plankton multiplied. In the broader context of this issue, there is a lot of discussion going on about whether or not there are things we could do on the planet to remove carbon from the atmosphere, just as we are now adding it. There are experiments, for example, being conducted by legitimate enterprise to try to inject the carbon back into the earth and trap it in underground repositories. There are, as I say, some fairly ambitious ideas beyond that, that we could somehow seed the oceans and generate a great deal of plankton, and plankton is a very good way to remove carbon from the atmosphere. So, you know, it sounds weird. It's not necessarily as far-fetched as all that, but the caution that environmental regulators have been issuing, especially in Canada since this story broke here about 10 days ago, reporting of a reporter named Margaret Monroe, the caution from Canada has been, this is very, very complicated stuff. Tampering with Mother Nature can be pretty dangerous, especially if, you know, you're going in largely unexplored territory, as this experiment did.
Speaking with Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. Vaughn, you sent me an article from the Wall Street Journal where China was expressing fears that Ottawa is rolling up the welcome mat to them. What's going on?
Well, there's been a lot of interest in Asia about buying a piece of the action in Canada's very successful energy industry, and there are a couple of major takeovers going on at the moment, or proposed takeovers. The big one that's been getting all the attention in Canada is the Chinese National Oil Company trying to acquire a Canadian company called Nexen, and that decision, that takeover, is still under review, and the government has, in fact, extended the period of time for reviewing the takeover. A lot of people were caught by surprise on Friday when the federal government rejected a takeover of another Canadian company by Petronas, the big Malaysian oil company. It's the one with the two towers in Malaysia. So that one has surprised a lot of the investment community and caught everyone by surprise. The government announced it was rejecting the takeover 3 minutes before midnight on Friday, which was the deadline for announcing a decision, and they gave no explanation. They did it with a 163-word statement saying no, that didn't say much else about why the Canadian government is supposed to provide reasons if it turns down a foreign takeover. In this case, it said next to nothing, and as I said, the fact that they just acted at the last minute has indeed got a lot of investors, a lot of people asking what the heck's going on. What are these mixed messages coming from Canada, and does our government really know what it's doing?
Has this had a ripple effect into other areas of Chinese investment in Canada?
What has happened since that is that there have been a lot of reassurances coming out this week that this one that was rejected Friday night will be coming back, that it was really a showdown, a kind of a game of chicken in the negotiations, that the Malaysian company will resubmit the bid, that it isn't an outright rejection, but rather a bargaining ploy, and that it will come back and it may end up being approved. That settled things down a bit here. The Chinese have now said, okay, well, we're still, our application on the other takeover is still subject to review, and will give the Canadian government the benefit of the doubt. But this is a big controversy in Canada. There's a feeling that our big resource companies are being bought up by some very deep-pocketed Asians. There's a concern about losing control of our economy, and a lot of public reservations. So this is a very, very tough call for the Canadian government, the Chinese one. The Malaysian one, it's not as big a takeover. My guess is if they come back with a revised proposal, may well get approved. But the bigger takeover, the one by the Chinese National Oil Company, and incidentally, that's the company that tried to take over Unocal in the United States that was turned down a few years ago. So that one may not go ahead. I think the Canadian government is really wrestling with this issue where they want investment in the Canadian economy. They like the fact that our economy is doing well. but they're aware of growing reservations among Canadians that were being bought out lock, stock, and barrel.
What is Prime Minister Stephen Harper's position when it comes to China and these big deals?
Oh, he's very, very enthusiastic about trade with China. His government has, in fact, recently signed a free trade agreement with China, which kicks in next week, and which it is under pressure at the moment to submit to debate in the National Parliament. It's so far received only about an hour of scrutiny. So, the government is sort of losing control of this issue in Canada, and I think they're going to have to retrench on this. Most Canadians, only in the last few days, have most Canadians even been made aware of what is called the Canada-China Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement, or FIPA, which was signed by the Prime Minister in Vladivostok, Russia, back in early September, and as I say, which kicks in next week, locked in for 15 years, and there's some debate as to whether or not it's a genuine, sweeping free trade agreement like the North American Free Trade Agreement, but when you consider how much scrutiny NAFTA got or the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement got, it's pretty amazing that this one, the government has basically just signed it and letting it take effect without any debate next week.
Is there anything that can be done, or is that just the way it's going to go? It's
public
taking
outcry,
effect.
I think what is happening now in Canada, particularly this week, is, as I say, is an awareness that the government was really trying to sneak one past people. I think if you put that into the mix along with this controversy over the big takeover of the oil company in Alberta by the Chinese National Oil Company, that I think the government's going to have to do something to address this concern because, as I said, a public opinion is mounting on this one. We've also got a running controversy here in British Columbia over a Chinese company that wants to develop a mine, an underground mine here in British Columbia, and it's bringing all of the workforce in from China. Well, you know, there's a Canadian feeling that we don't need to entirely staff these things with foreign workers. Why can't Canadians be trained to do this? Why are we bringing in people from China and running ads saying that in order to work in this mine, being able to speak Mandarin Chinese would be an advantage? That's not the thing you want to tell unemployed Canadian workers.
Well, and just like in the United States, it's lopsided how much exporting you're doing to Canada or to China from Canada.
Yes. Yeah, it's been pointed out that there is no way that the Chinese would allow one of their major oil companies to be taken over by a Canadian company. They would see that as a strategic part of their economy. You'd be forced into a partnership with a Chinese company. They do not reciprocate on these matters, which is, I think, why a lot of analysts, even analysts who support free trade, say that the concept of free trade with a controlled central economy like China is kind of meaningless, that it's not an even playing field, and so we should be very hesitant about getting involved in it.
Well, before we're completely out of time, I want to talk about this anti-pipeline protest that happened in British Columbia on Monday.
Yeah, we had a big protest here at the legislature buildings in Victoria. The organizers were promising mass civil disobedience and one of the biggest demonstrations in a long time. Didn't come out that way. There was no mass civil disobedience. It was a very orderly, peaceful protest on the front lawn of our legislature buildings, 24 speeches. About 2,000 or 3,000 people showed up and so I think made the point that British Columbians are concerned about oil pipelines, about shipping oil on the coast. But, you know, there's so much public opposition in this province to this big proposed pipeline they want to put through northern British Columbia that I'll be very surprised if it goes ahead anyway. I think that may be why some people didn't show up for the protest, is they figured the issue is over already.
So a little bit disappointing that you didn't get mass civil disobedience.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they were thinking about. I mean, protests at our legislature are routine. They happen all the time. The guards and the police are used to letting them go ahead. It's not civil disobedience to protest at the legislature of BC. It's routine. Sometimes there's so many protests going on that you practically have to book the lawn ahead to make sure that someone else hasn't already taken it for their protest.
Oh, that's great. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. Thanks for talking to us, Vaughn.
Talk to you next week.
This is Weekday.
Bye-bye.
19 minutes after 10 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. Last month, gubernatorial candidate Rob McKenna came into the KUOW studios, laid out his vision and goals for the state of Washington. Today, we'll hear from Democrat Jay Inslee. He sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
Clouds and showers in Seattle, 49 degrees in the University District, working towards a high today of 51. We're expecting clouds and rain all afternoon. Tonight and tomorrow, clouds with a chance of showers. Tonight's low 40, tomorrow's high reaching 53.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go.
That's the treat you're getting out in the lobby now. Because you know who's serving you that popcorn? Robert Horton, you know who's serving you this popcorn?
Who's serving?
Zombies.
Ah.
Zombies are serving popcorn.
With brains.
With brains.
Yes.
Just in time for Halloween, Robert Horton, who reviews films for us at KUOW and talks about the culture surrounding them, also writes at the Herald and Everett. And on his own website, The Crop Duster, he's been thinking about, he's been thinking about zombies. Why not?
Why not?
It's Halloween. Do we know the origin of the zombie? Has the zombie been around for a long time?
I think the zombie has been around a long time. I haven't looked into it in a while, but I think at one point I was reading about a word. Some people call them jumbies, which it's some people think might be the origin of the word zombie. There are a couple of other theories. Maybe that it comes from French, colonial French. But it's a longstanding belief that the dead might be kind of halfway revived.
Yeah.
And put to work.
Yeah. And I think it's been proven time and time again in the film that it's not a good idea.
It rarely works out well in fiction anyway. I don't know about reality. I don't know if reality, it has worked out. Possibly it has.
It depends on if you think maybe there are zombies do good work. I can't say. I can't speak to that.
Are they productive?
Productive members of zombie society.
Yeah. What else matters?
All right. What's the first appearance of the zombie? Well, you're looking at the 30s, so I guess first zombies in black and white.
I was just thinking about black and white zombies. I was just thinking about old school zombie films, and I thought of three that I really like. And I don't know why, but I do enjoy horror films, and I have enjoyed some of the more recent zombie films as well. But I was thinking of these three films just because there's something about black and white that really brings out a certain spookiness, and also even like the soundtrack sounds different when some of those early sound movies, of which we have a couple here on our docket.
On our docket. Yeah, white zombie. Now, what's the origin of white zombie?
White zombie. Well, it's a 1932 movie, and I suspect that it was part of it was kind of the cultural moment in a way of that time, because a guy named William Seabrook had written this book that at least purported to talk about his visit to Haiti, and that he had observed weird voodoo rites, possibly things involving zombies, people who had died and then kind of been brought back to life. And this book, I haven't read it. I want to read it, but it apparently was very lurid, and it captured the imagination of the country for a little while. It was just considered very exotic and, you know, intriguing. And I think it caused some interest in Hollywood. And White Zombie was one of the films that came out of that interest.
You know, I would just like to say that Seabrook, he was your kind of adventurer, right? You liked the kind of adventures that man went on.
He was a strange guy. You know, He was interested in weird things. I don't know if I would have the nerve to do that, but he was one of those odd 1920s era guys who would go galloping around looking for stuff.
He decided to find out if people were cannibals. He wanted to know more about it.
He did. He did try firsthand some. He said he tried some human flesh. Yeah.
You have somebody who wasn't murdered but had recently been killed. I find that to be a disturbing distinction.
Well, I guess it made him sleep easier. I don't know. I would not condone that.
No. Well, was it a good movie?
White Zombie is it's one of those things. I'm not sure it's a really good movie, but it really casts an eerie spell. Part because of its age, because of when it was made, and that kind of strange quality of early sound movies, and it's got, not only does it have, you know, a lot of atmosphere and this idea of people going down to Haiti and finding themselves in over their heads and so on, but it ups the ante by putting in Bela Lugosi in the cast. And Lugosi had made Dracula a year before that and was this exotic person in Hollywood. And so he's the guy down in Haiti who knows a few too many things about whatever's going on with the voodoo people and possibly the makers of zombies. And that just adds a nice little extra fillip to the movie. And the people who made the movie, clearly, they had seen Dracula, and so they kind of photograph Lugosi in certain ways that sustain that mood.
Well, it looks frightening.
It's a weird one. It's genuinely weird. Artifact of its time, but it kind of gets under your skin.
All right, so what about Black Moon?
Yes, now Black Moon is 1934, so a couple of years later, but still kind of in the same, picking up the same vibe of this interest in the possible origins of Caribbean weirdness. And it's about this woman who, well this really four-square guy has married a woman who was raised on, I'm not sure if they say, some of these movies they name it Haiti and sometimes they call it something else, but she was raised there. In the only white family that lived on this island, supposedly. And somehow she has gotten to know certain occult practices in her past that seem to be still haunting her. And so the movie starts in the husband's world, in, you know, just like the business world of the United States. And this woman obviously does not fit there at all. Something's off. And she goes back for a trip to her home island, and you pretty much know that she's not going to be able to resist the lure of ancient drums in the jungle, and that she'll be called back to unspeakable acts that were going on out there somehow.
Do you see any in the movie?
No. Well, the cool thing is, I think it works really well that it perhaps by most of it is left to your imagination, and so really you can just think of the many strange things that were probably going on out there.
Can I just play a little bit from this?
Sure.
You can almost guess what's happening in the film, right? The woman has succumbed to the drums, and she is now about to go through a ritual.
Torches are burning. Bad things are happening. I think that fascination with some kind of rite, you know, that was a sort of a dark rite outside of what we knew in our civilized world is a large part of the appeal of Seabrook's book and of these early movies.
So Seabrook comes along. I mean, we didn't really have, did we not really have the kind of zombie in literature before that, do you think?
Well, you can have people who, I mean, they played around with ideas of bringing people back from the dead and all that, but the idea of calling them zombies, as I understand it, sort of got ushered in during that era of the 1920s. I don't think anybody mentions the word zombie in Black Moon. I think it's more of a voodoo thing, and they allude to maybe bringing people back from the dead, but it's a really underrated film. Very, very, it's got a high misterioso element to it.
Well, that's great. I mean, as we know, zombies, they're everywhere. They're everywhere now.
They certainly are. Look around you.
You have zombies in Rotten, your comic book, right?
I have written about zombies, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of captivated the modern sensibility, the zeitgeist.
It certainly has.
Even the joke books, or are they jokes about how to survive a zombie attack, a zombie apocalypse?
That's right. Yeah, it just keeps, seems to keep going. It's kind of interesting. The metaphor of the zombie is so available for any and all purposes. And, you know, I think I've been thinking lately the low-information voter that we keep hearing about. You can kind of imagine these people staggering
voters.
Around. I don't know.
Nice.
What other excuse do they have, really, at this point?
Zombie voters staggering in front of the polling station.
Getting to the polls.
Zombie candidates. I've seen that a few times.
Well, I think we have many of those.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think
that's always been true, probably.
I think some people are labeling the wrong people as zombie candidates, considering what's happening in the election right now. All right. What about this? Was this the most famous one? I walked with a zombie.
I think it's the most famous one of this era. Yeah, and happens to be really a favorite film of mine. I'm very fond of this film. It was made 1943 by kind of a semi-legendary Hollywood low-budget producer named Val Lewton. Cat People, the guy who made Cat People, and his crack director Jacques Tourneur. And it was it kind of has the same sorts of elements, people going to an island. I think they call it San Sebastian in this case. I think they fictionalize it, and odd things are happening. A young woman goes there to be a nurse, basically. And Lewton was very honest about the fact that they stole the plot from Jane Eyre. They just needed a plot, and so they kind of took Jane Eyre with the brooding man who has the strange, you know, wife hidden away, and this young woman who goes into the house to be a sort of a nursemaid. But they set it on a Caribbean island and put some zombies in it.
Yeah, can I play a little bit of the trailer from this?
I think you'll
like this.
And out of their West Indian island comes a tale of terror and voodoo, of witchcraft and zombies, and all the weird black magic that the white man seldom sees. It is a tale of brother against brother, and their love for a woman who lived with the dead. And it is also the tale of a young nurse who never believed such things could happen.
Well, that's what happens when you leave the prairie and head out into the real world.
Well, that that announcer was playing into exactly what we were talking about. I think that was the lurid, you know, hook for this thing, was that somehow you were going to see things.
Yeah, nice little not so subtle racism there as well.
Well, that white people would rarely have seen.
Yeah,
and it's of course that tone of the trailer is somewhat misleading to the movie itself, because the film is quite consciously poetic. It is a very kind of delicate artifact that's been put together, and occasionally stops for these passages of silence, or if not exactly silence, at least the sounds of the island and sounds of music and so on, and really pretty wonderful film. And actually has a much a lot of Lewton's films were, in terms of treating black characters and white characters, a little more advanced than most Hollywood films at that time.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So though that announcer said one thing, the characters were actually respected a bit more.
Yeah,
the races
of the you can never trust trailers then or now.
Yeah. White Zombie, Black Moon, which really would be a fine movie too. Zombie, Black Moon.
That's a good double bill. Yeah.
And I Walked with a Zombie. Three films that Robert Horton's been thinking about that are about zombies. Are there great? So what's a modern film that has zombies in it that you think in some way can be on the pedestal with these other three mm-hmm. films?
Well, you know, the dean of the modern zombie film is George Romero, and he's done pretty well with his series, and some of them are better than others, but boy, oh boy, Night of Living Dead is still kind of an amazing movie, yeah.
Well, politically, it had a lot of politics in there, right?
It came along right at the right time, and it was intentional in its political force, and so was Dawn of the Dead, which was 10 years later.
And by the way, Political Force, its view of American racial prejudice and bigotry and all that, that was all part of that film as well.
Yeah, especially, well, we won't give it away, but especially when you get to the ending.
Yeah.
Romero has stuck with it, and what, 5 or 6 years ago, he made Land of the Dead, which was yet another one of these that was actually, I think, one of his best in a long time.
Really?
Dennis Hopper was in there, and it also had, he was picking up big time on the kind of political mood of the country back then, and go ahead, you know, putting it in the frame of a horror movie with zombies and really making it work very, very cleverly, I think.
All right. You're a man who likes the zombie.
Well, at least once a year. More often than that, I guess.
Is that right?
Well, thanks to Rotten.
Yeah.
Got to write these things.
Rotten, the comic book, has Westerners, because they're in a Western.
Real Westerners.
Yeah, we are real Westerners. They're fighting zombies right and left. Some kind of virus, some kind of plague.
Yeah, something's going on.
We don't really know.
It's a mystery.
It's an enigma.
They're trying to get to the bottom of it, yes.
Zombie movies. All right. For Halloween, you're going to dress up as a zombie then?
It would be hard to tell the difference with me. I don't know. That remains to be seen.
Here's a little music from Dawn of the Dead to go out. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, Steve.
Good morning, it's 10:36. I'm Andy Hurst. We have clouds and showers in Seattle, 49 degrees right now in the University District. We're working towards a high of 51 today. Forecast calls for clouds and showers. Tonight and tomorrow, clouds with a chance of showers. Tonight's low 40, tomorrow's high reaching 53.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, serving Seattle since 1958, a full-service Volkswagen and Audi dealership offering a selection of new and pre-owned automobiles, located in the University District on Roosevelt Way. More info online at uvwaudi.com.
Forget medical marijuana. This year, three states feature ballot measures asking voters if they want to legalize pot for recreational use.
This would free up precious police resources to go after real criminals, drunk drivers, etc., as opposed to wasting time on a green plant.
Changing marijuana laws, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell, joined now by Todd Bishop, who's co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, an independent technology news site based in Seattle. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Katie. It's great to be here.
Big, huge tech week.
Gigantic. Yeah, we had tons of news. It started, started yesterday with Apple announcing the iPad mini, and then later on in the week, Microsoft will be coming out with the new Windows 8 and its first full-fledged computer, the Surface. So it's a giant week. I'm working some long hours this week.
I bet you are. So I assume that the Apple release of the Mini yesterday was to scoop Microsoft.
It was, and in fact, it was funny. They announced the iPad Mini and some other products, and the pre-orders will start on October 26th, Friday, which for many months has been known to be the Windows 8 release date. So you see Tim Cook and Phil Schiller and some of the other execs from Apple sort of poking in the ribs of Microsoft a little bit on that one.
Have you heard any response from Microsoft on that?
No, Microsoft is pretty heads down. In fact, it's hard to get a lot of information out of the company in terms of fresh stuff right now, just because so many of the teams, at least the Windows folks, are headed back to New York City for the launch, which will actually be Thursday. They'll do sort of a launch. It's still that traditional media cycle where they have the event on Thursday, and then they assume that the papers are going to pick it up the next morning when they have the product in the stores.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the iPad Mini.
Yes.
What can you tell us about it?
So the iPad Mini, it's The key detail is, well, first off, the size, of course. It's 7.9 inches diagonal, which is a little bit bigger than the original Kindle Fire, a little bit smaller than the new larger size Kindle Fire HD, which is more than 8 inches. It's really designed to be able to take it without any kind of bag. And of course, you can do that with your iPad now, but it's almost pocketable in a lot of ways. And for some people, it will be pocketable and something that they can just take with them and really not have to worry about carrying a bag with them. The key issue is price. $329 is the starting price. If you compare it to similar models from Amazon, they are not competing on price. Apple is not competing on price here. They're still following their traditional model of the premium product targeted at people who are willing to pay a little bit more, or in some cases a lot more, for something that is just over and above better in the view of those people.
Is that partly because they just feel like if they were to compete more head-to-head, say, with the Amazon Kindle Fire, that it somehow degrades how we feel about Apple?
It does. That's the case. And it also allows them to use higher quality materials in the product. So to some extent, the perception of it being a premium product because of the price actually is true, because they're able to use the materials and components that are just a little bit better, metals instead of plastics in some cases. And so in the end, you end up with a product that for the most part is potentially worth the price. And of course, I haven't held an iPad mini, but it certainly looks interesting.
So it wasn't the only product that Apple revealed. Didn't they also reveal like a different desktop screen?
Yes, exactly. So they came out with a new iMac that they announced. They upgraded the current full-fledged iPad, which is actually frustrating some folks, because it was just a few months ago, earlier this year, that they came out with the third generation iPad, and now they're already coming out with the fourth generation, which is mostly different under the hood. Lots of improvements in things like the processor and the graphics, but here you have people who just plunked down hundreds and hundreds of dollars for what they thought was going to be Apple's next big thing for at least a year, and their neighbor's going to have something that's a lot better at essentially the same price.
Do you have a sense of why they did that?
You know, I don't. It's a really good question. I think it had to do in part with the timing of the iPad mini release and the fact that they, you know, were up on stage yesterday and were in a position to announce it. It's a fascinating move because it really shortens the life cycle and it makes it so that people are, you know, potentially even motivated to go out and buy a new iPad. And in some ways, that really speaks to the difference between the Apple and Amazon philosophies. And Jeff Bezos had this fascinating sort of lecture during Amazon's last press event. He called it the Amazon Doctrine. And he said that Amazon's goal is to make money when you use its products, not when you buy them. So in other words, they're essentially selling a lot of their hardware at cost and assuming that the content that you buy and the media that you consume through those devices is where they're going to make their money. And here you have Apple doing essentially the opposite and saying, hey, here's our new product. About 6 months later, please buy this as well.
So Amazon's trying to position itself as being more noble, perhaps.
In some ways, although Bezos in some follow-up interviews was careful to say, hey, we're not being high and mighty here. We just think this is right for Amazon. And in the end, they think it's right for the customer. But they tried to say, we're not trying to claim superiority in this realm.
Can I ask you, when I was reading about the new desktop computer that Apple came out, it raised the question to me is, what is the consumer's obsession with thin? I understand small, because small means portability, but if it's going to be a desktop computer, why do we want the monitor to be thin?
Yeah, it's a great point. Other than aesthetics and some kind of thing in the back of your mind where you know you've got the most compact possible screen on your desk, I agree with you. When they were going over the millimeter differences between the new iMac and the old one, It was a little comical because, of course, you care about that with something you carry around in your pocket. You care about size and every millimeter matters. But I guess just because it's cool.
Thin is in. Todd Bishop is co-founder and national editor of GeekWire. Let's switch to Microsoft, because Microsoft is releasing Windows 8 this week. Can you explain to us what's different about Windows 8?
Yes, everything.
Wow, okay.
So Windows 8 is essentially built first for tablets. When people open up Windows 8 for the first time on either a desktop computer or a tablet, they will see a start screen that is much more like the Xbox interface. It has large tiles that are associated with applications. And through those tiles, you'll see information bubbling up from the programs, such as your latest email or your latest news headlines. And you also will, of course, click on the tiles to launch the program, just like you used to with icons. But it's the default across every Windows 8 machine that's going to be coming out. And that is where the big adjustment is going to be for a lot of people who are used to the traditional Windows metaphor on desktop machines. It's very different. Now, you can use the traditional desktop, but even there, the start button in the lower left-hand corner is gone, and you'll go down there with your mouse, and instead you'll be given an icon that represents the start screen, and you can click there to go to the start screen, or you can move your mouse up to see other open applications that you have. It is a new way of using Windows for really the first time in decades, and it's going to be a major learning curve for a lot of people.
So is that a good thing?
Potentially. Here's the deal. There is a big debate going on right now among a lot of journalists and pundits and people who are using this in test form. And a lot of folks are saying, hey, this is going to be too much of a learning curve for the average person out there. For example, I sit there and I think, should I recommend that my mom and dad upgrade from their existing Windows 7 machines to Windows 8? And right now, the answer for me is no, I would not recommend that they do it. Now, it's a great experience on a tablet. And so if Microsoft can get the public past this learning curve, it's a very good thing for Microsoft because they will then have a common interface that's widely used across PCs, the game console, and Windows Phone. And once any one of those things becomes familiar for one person, then the other things become familiar as well because the interface is similar. So if you're using Windows 8 and you go to a store and you're comparing a Windows phone to an iPhone or an Android device, you're at least a little more likely to go with the Windows phone because, hey, that's the thing that's on my Xbox or that's the same thing that's on my desktop at home.
Does it relate at all to... There's always been that difficulty where if you have a PC at work and you have an Apple at home, you have to do that mental translation between how each machine works. Does it make that translation any easier for people who have both computers?
It actually makes it a little bit tougher because both Mac OS X and Windows, up until Windows 7, have essentially had somewhat similar, I guess the word would be metaphors. You know, that you've got a screen that looks like a desktop, you know, and you've got icons that represent programs, and OS X is, for the most part, sticking with that, although they've incorporated some elements of iOS, the mobile operating system from Apple. And now here you have Microsoft on its desktop and tablet and phone going in a completely different direction. So, you know, to some extent, it sort of exaggerates or amplifies the differences between Mac and Windows.
Well, another cool thing that Microsoft is releasing is Smart Glass for the Xbox.
Yes.
What is Smart Glass?
So Smart Glass is an application that will run first on Windows 8 and then on Windows Phone and then later actually on iPhone, iPad, and Android. It acts as a second screen for your TV. So you're using your Xbox and you want to call up a game or you want to browse media content, you'll actually be able to start on the device in your lap and then sort of send content to your TV, or you'll be able to do other things like you'll be able to essentially control the web browser on your TV with the Smart Glass application. So you'll do your pinching and your zooming on the screen in your lap, and it will affect Internet Explorer, which just debuted on Xbox Live this week, up on your TV screen. So it's actually a fascinating move by Microsoft and something that at least will differentiate Windows 8 for the time being, but it gets into that whole point of Android and iPhone are so prevalent right now and really dominating the mobile landscape. It actually speaks volumes that Microsoft could not avoid coming out with smart glass app for those two devices as well, even though they compete with Windows Phone.
Interesting. Well, there's another milestone that Microsoft hit this week that has nothing to do with any new products that they're releasing. What was that milestone?
So you're talking about the philanthropic milestone.
Yeah.
They marked their – it actually speaks to Microsoft's impact on the region in some ways. And, of course, there's lots of public relations involved in this on their part. But they reached $1 billion in giving. Now, this is Microsoft, not the Gates Foundation, which obviously gives a lot more than that, and its endowment is much, much larger. But in terms of Microsoft's giving to community organizations and other groups and its philanthropy that it does through its employees and its own giving fund, they reached $1 billion over the past three decades. And Bill Gates actually made a rare appearance back on the Microsoft campus. You don't see Bill Gates on Microsoft's campus. He returns for private meetings, but in terms of public appearances, it's pretty rare. So he went back for this.
They said that they gave to 31,000 nonprofits over the last 30 years. I mean, that's a pretty huge impact. Do you know which nonprofits got most of the money?
I don't know the specific ones that got the most money. You know, they are very close to the United Way of King County. And in fact, some of their executives have served as representatives on the United Way board and led those kinds of campaigns. So that is one of the primary affiliations that they have.
Well, one of the things they said in the presentation that they made to honor this achievement was they noted that giving has become part of the fabric of the organization. And that got me wondering, are there other big tech companies that are an example of this?
Maybe not on the same level. And Microsoft, to its credit, has been doing this for a very long time. But you have seen companies like Google, for example, do things either through their nonprofit arm or through their employee giving that are similar, at least. And it was interesting. Brad Smith, Microsoft's general counsel and the person who oversees a lot of this stuff, actually said he sees this as a competitive advantage for Microsoft in recruiting, which is actually somewhat heartening because we went through that period maybe before the recession where the perks, the sort of the individual employee perks like free massages, on-site health care,
free soda,
dry cleaning. And Microsoft still does have free soda. That's sort of like their bottom line staple. but that was really what was the method that these companies were using to try and attract and retain people. And if in fact philanthropy is replacing that, that's a good thing for the world, potentially.
Yeah, it is interesting. And they also, I was surprised to learn that they also give money when you volunteer.
Yes.
Which is kind of an interesting thing.
They do matching funds to essentially match either your financial donation or the time that you spend with a specific organization as an employee.
Speaking with Todd Bishop, co-founder, national editor of GeekWire, who's having an incredibly busy week this week in Seattle, covering all these new technological advances, I guess we could say. Let's talk a little personal about the Microsoft Surface.
Yes.
your wife was planning to buy an iPad, and you talked her into getting a Windows Surface instead. So maybe we should say, what is Microsoft Surface, and then why did you decide to talk your wife into it?
So Surface is Microsoft's answer to the iPad. And it's interesting in part because Microsoft has never before made a computer soup to nuts. And this is Microsoft doing everything from the operating system to the applications to the online services to the underlying hardware. And it's a tablet that has, as its signature feature, a keyboard that snaps in to the bottom and is apparently better than some of the iPad accessories out there, according to some of the reviews. Mm-hmm. And so Microsoft is attempting to compete with the iPad with this. In my family, yes, I wrote about this last week. We had budget set aside for an iPad, and at the last minute I convinced my wife on the first day of Microsoft Surface pre-orders to give it a shot. And so we spent the money instead on the Surface. Somebody else said we blew the money instead on the Surface. In part, I've been encouraging this for a while. I think there's something to be said for one company doing everything end to end, making a computer a singular product and not a combination of two things. And so in part, I wanted to put my money where my mouth was and say, okay, Microsoft, you've done it. I guess I'll buy the thing.
Well, and you told your wife it was going to be great.
I did. Well, you know how you tell your spouses and significant others things that you aspire to be true. So, you know, at least in my house, you know, I'll be talking about some of the strong points of the Surface, including the smart glass application. But I'll be reviewing it on the site and as well. And try and bring some reality to it. The good thing is one of our readers has already offered to trade his iPad 3 for my Surface if I don't like it. So I kind of have a hedge in some ways.
That's really funny. I love that you have all these people that are like, well, you can switch it out with me. Exactly. I would like somebody to do that with my phone, but I don't know that they would. I just want to kind of go off a little bit the news of the week and ask you some personal questions just because I was curious. What kind of technology for you personally like piques your interest the most?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's more the refinement of what I'm already using and figuring out how to get more out of what I already have. I mean, frankly, a lot of times, you know, people line up around the block to get some new device and they're not using, you know, 30% of the stuff that's in their existing device. And I'll give you two quick examples. There's a great Chrome plugin, a browser plugin for the Chrome browser made by Amazon that lets you automatically send content to your Kindle for reading later. And I'll use this, you know, colleagues send you long form stuff and long, you know, New Yorker pieces or whatever. And it really can interrupt your workflow if you sit there and spend 10, 20 minutes digesting this story. And so what I do is I hit my send to Kindle button. You can even have a little keyboard shortcut. And it's waiting for me at night on my Kindle, and I can spend more time with it. I love stuff like that. There's a program on OS X called Automator that allows you to automate specific tasks. And I've got it set up to where I use my iFi card on my camera, which automatically pulls in pictures off the camera without having to sync.
Oh.
And then I have it go into a folder that Automator recognizes, and it automatically resizes and gets it ready for it to post on our blog. And I'm the next step, I want to get it so it can automatically FTP to our blog. So I can take a picture on my camera and have it automatically show up in the media library on our website without me doing anything in between. That's sort of my ultimate.
Wow.
So it's a couple examples of trying to get more out of technology.
That would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it is possible. I just haven't quite gotten it down.
So can I go in the reverse direction and ask you if there's a piece of technology that you had maybe in your youth that you miss?
You know, it's funny. We just did a funny piece on video games on the site. Our colleague Taylor Soper, our new reporter actually, went out to the Sounders game and asked Sounders fans wearing their Xbox 360 jerseys what their favorite game console was of all time.
Oh, right.
Very few people actually said the Xbox 360, which was kind of what we were going for with that thing. But it jogged my memory. My favorite game console of all time from my youth, ColecoVision.
Did you
remember ColecoVision?
Of course. Yes. Yes, of course.
Yes. I think Mousetrap, if I remember correctly, was my favorite game. My friend Carl and I would spend hours, way too many hours, playing ColecoVision. But something about the simplicity of that, And you really do see a little bit of that returning through these casual games that we play on our mobile devices, where you can pick it up and not have to spend 2 hours on some campaign, you know, shooting at people. You can just have a fun, light experience that you can pick up and put down. And that it's really actually been nice to see some of the mobile games returning to that spirit.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a game called Downland I loved as a kid.
Downland.
That I just cannot.
What console was that?
Gone. Oh, I think it was whatever computer came before the Tandy 1000.
Okay.
Had a tape player, you know, to load the game.
Sweet.
Yeah, you remember that?
Nice.
Todd Bishop is co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, an independent technology news site in Seattle. He'll be posting stuff all week long about all these new innovations that are coming out. Thanks for taking the time to come in.
Thank you, Katie.
Weekday is produced by Jason Vigano and Amina Alsadi. Andy Hurst is the engineer. We get help from Alexandra Garrettin and Danielle Anthony Goodwin. Steve Scherer will be back. I'm Katie Sewell filling in today. Have a good day.
It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Overlake School in Redmond, providing a rigorous college prep curriculum and a wide range of arts and athletics for grades 5 through 12. Open house for grades 7 through 12, October 31st from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Reservations required. Details at overlake.org.
On one fateful night in 1938, thousands of men and women ran from their homes convinced that Martians were invading. All because of a radio play.
But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear.
Okay, were we really so unsophisticated back then? Could the War of the Worlds happen again? Here's a hint, yes. We'll find out on the next Radio Lab, where we'll come to you.
Live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And the next Radio Lab is Friday night at...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.